Welcome to WPKN's Resistance Roundtable, coming to you the second Saturday of each month from 10 to 11 a.m. In this hour, we'll talk about some of the breaking developments and resistance to the disasters and near disasters of the Trump administration with our regular panel, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Scott Harris, and myself, Richard Hill. Ruth Ann, who will be joining us by phone today, teaches English at Central Connecticut State University and is active in the American Association of University Professors. She also directs plays for the Westport Community Theater, and we hope someday soon she may resume that activity. Scott Harris is the host of Counterpoint, a public affairs show that airs every Monday at 8 p.m. here on PKN. He's also the executive director of Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, a nationally syndicated show that airs here on WPKN. I host First Tuesday Rainy Day Radio, the Organic Farm Stand, and I'm on the roster of hosts for the public affairs show Mic Check, which airs every Sunday at 5:30 p.m. on WPKN. And this week we'll be joined by a special guest, John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine and author of many books, including the forthcoming The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. John will talk about the approaching total economic and political collapse as Senate Republicans refuse to act on evictions, unemployment, support for states and schools, and so much more. So there are many issues on the table at this moment as we round the corner into the stretch toward the November elections. Let's check in with our panelists, Ruth Ann and Scott, for their comments. And later in the show, we'll open the phones for questions and comments from our listeners. But Ruth Ann, are you prepared to be pithy and provocative this morning?
I'm not sure about it. Pretty pithy. This started out as bullet points, but it turned into a traditional rant. And it's called Current Events or Power to the People. We've been calling our neighbor Macbeth because his generator has murdered sleep. Since Tuesday night, he's been running that thing off and on. It's located a dozen or so feet from our house. The sound is particularly assertive in the kitchen, dining room, and bedroom. We're reminded by our hand crank radio that the largest outage areas have to be dealt with first, but the 8-house cul-de-sac that abuts our backyard got power back 2 nights ago. There's street lights, a little diamond bracelet in the dark. Last night they had a party with a live band and amps. I hope they maintain social distancing. Meanwhile, 2 days ago, we spent the afternoon at the senior center charging our phones and took a drive yesterday to do the same. It seems small to complain when we're only one household of about 1 million and nobody here is dependent on a well pump or an oxygen tank. But as someone on my Nextdoor Jennings e-chat list wrote last night, every time we have a weather issue, it's like it never happened before. The usual, we are working hard to implement protocols so this won't happen again, and when it happens again, they are not prepared. When I check the UI emergency phone for updates, the message always begins with the warning to deadbeats that if their power has been shut off for non-payment, it will be restored 24 hours after payment is made. Then the storm info follows, quote, working hard, power somewhere soon. When I first moved to this neighborhood in 2003, I began meeting neighbors one sunny day when we suddenly lost power. For some reason, we all gathered in the middle of the street to talk. Speculation was that it was a terrorist act. Turns out it was just another outage. Those were simpler days. Now we're dependent on that electric grid for important and casual communication, for shopping, for information, for quick medical consultation, and in these COVID days for work and school. This week I missed 2 online training sessions for the systems I'll be using to teach remotely at CCSU this fall. As global warming and climate change seem to be accelerating while we play golf, we have to expect more and more power emergencies in combination with fire, flood, storm, and plague. They can sow more havoc than a whole gang of terrorists. Yet power companies and politicians seem powerless, literally, while they charge a dependent population more and more for the pleasure. If my emails from governor and local officials are any indication, at least briefly, both parties are in agreement that something has to be done. Here are some suggestions. Bury the damn wires. Give every electric grid customer a complimentary generator as standard equipment, so when one carbon-fueled power source collapses, there will be a second carbon-fueled device to fill in. That'll be a noise fest. Pay people the full freight to install solar power, so they will have some independent power source. These and other ideas should be seriously pursued. Yes, they will cost time and money and thought, just what the repeated energy crises cost now. Meanwhile, the government is free to investigate what went wrong. But we already know what went wrong. Clinical perseverance, trying harder with the same solution, no matter how often it fails. One of the urgent priorities for the next administration has got to be a new and comprehensive solution to the whole energy picture and the catastrophes that seem to be coming at millions of individuals. Apologies and rate increases won't do it. Time to think outside the circuit box. Humans accept government because more can be achieved by organized collaborative action than by a patchwork of individual efforts. If we are on our own, stop taking our money. If you are accepting the power, accept the responsibility. Use your resources of well-educated experts, global reach, and financial wealth to find a way to do the job that has been entrusted to you. P.S. An apology. There are no data in this presentation. My internet is inaccessible with my devices. And I'm also sorry for the disorganization and emotion, thanks to Macbeth. That's all I have to say, really. Well, I have a lot more to say, but I cut it out because I didn't want to monopolize. I'm excited about getting to hear John Nichols. So I yield the rest of my time.
Excellent, Ruthann. Well spoken. And Scott Harris, what are you grinding your teeth about this morning?
Well, like Ruth, I want to offer my greetings and solidarity to all of my brothers and sisters who are out there without power and the usual electric conveniences like hot showers, cell phones, and toast. Toast was a big one. My topic really revolves around the very dangerous times we're living in. I think in these months ahead leading up to the presidential election, we are, I think we're up against some really malevolent possibilities. And given that Donald Trump has proven thoroughly over this last 3.5 years that he is completely and thoroughly amoral with a depraved indifference toward human life, that makes this next few months where he's desperate for re-election all the more critical. His deliberate sabotage of the federal pandemic response is responsible for killing tens of thousands of Americans, and he did this, of course, in the interest of his re-election. And the Republican Party, such as governors in Florida, DeSantis, Texas Governor Abbott, and Arizona Governor Ducey followed Trump's misguided decision to ignore public health officials' guidance in controlling the coronavirus, again, because they thought it would be politically advantageous. Now the Trump regime is attempting to slow down the mail with Trump mega donor and a newly appointed Postmaster General DeJoy doing his best to destroy the post office to make way for its eventual privatization, which is a long-standing Republican goal, and in the short term, to destroy the post office ability to deliver mail and ballots on time for the election, which either could be a strategy to prevent all those Democratic voters from getting their ballots counted, or just to sow more chaos so that Trump can declare martial law and not allow the election to go forward, or to declare it a rigged game, which he's done already, right? He's given us fair warning of that. The other problems I think we face or threats we face, the deployment of the secret federal police to Portland, Oregon, and some other cities could foreshadow a possibility of these same federal forces descending on polling booths the day of the election. There's been concern about that, along with some right-wing extremist militia types who've put out the call. These are Trump supporters who put out the call for some 50,000 former Navy SEALs and or ex-military to come to the polls with the, I don't think it's completely spelled out in the call, but it's obviously to intimidate voters of a certain type. We also have Trump's recent call out, again in desperation, a la the policies of George Wallace back in 1968, to declare his support for segregation in housing. He's trying to get the white vote, obviously, that he's got locked up back in 2016 and may have a harder time getting this time around, given so many of his supporters have been killed by the coronavirus. But, yeah, he's using the megaphone, the toxic megaphone he uses to extol racism and segregation, telling voters in the suburbs that, yes, he's going to abolish all the rules as best he can to prevent low-income, a la communities of color, from moving in next door to you. And I think he said in his own words, devaluing your property. And then, of course, we've got the topic we're going to be discussing more of today, the Republican Senate, no movement on extending unemployment insurance or a moratorium on eviction. And as Richard said, also, there's been no funding for the states, which are going to have to do massive layoffs of public workers and teachers and all manner of critical employees of any state government because there's no backup for the lost revenue over these last four or five months with the pandemic. And then we've got a possible October surprise with Trump rushing out a vaccine that's unproven, untested, and could do a lot of damage because he's, again, desperate for reelection. He may break all the rules of public health and put a new vaccine out there in hopes that he'll get some extra votes for being so quick to find the quote-unquote cure. But without the proper vetting, a vaccine could be deadly. And then we have the threat of war or some other malevolent, last-ditch, desperate effort on the part of Trump to turn public opinion around in an attempt to re-election. I can't predict what that will be, but I think we've got enough examples of what he's already in the process of doing to be pretty concerned about what's likely to happen over these next bunch of weeks before the November election. So with that bit of optimism and sunshine, I leave it to you, Richard.
Thank you so much, Scott. Well, I'm going to quickly launch into some presidential politics or vice presidential politics. I saw an article, and probably you guys did too, about this ludicrous plan to get Kanye West on the ballot in certain key states that would be regarded as, you know, a strategic move to peel away voters, black voters, from Biden and put them in the Trump column. So the headline for that article is GOP plan to beat Biden by pushing Kanye West could backfire on Trump. Subhead is political experts warn that African Americans don't vote for candidates just because they are black. David Jackson, the author, goes on to say African Americans tend not to vote for candidates solely because they are black. And Kanye West's status with Americans age 18 through 29 is actually more unfavorable than favorable. But I'd like to look at this from the other side of the strategy, and that is that white Americans probably do vote for candidates based on their race and are less likely to vote for a black candidate or other candidates of color. And I wonder if this point is being weighed in the Biden camp's strategy as they inch toward picking a running mate. Biden has already committed to choosing a woman for vice president, and he has been coyly flirting with picking a black woman for the job. But just what kind of black woman? We've heard in the last couple of days that it has all come down to Kamala Harris and Susan Rice, two light-skinned black women with dubious progressive credentials who are less likely to, and I use this word advisedly, to frighten centrist whites, white voters, but which, and again, in quotes, technically meet the demand of African Americans, especially women, for a black woman to be on the ticket. If Biden chooses this course, he might be committing a strategic blunder. Will minority communities be fired up and willing to stand in line for hours to vote for these establishment Democrats, even if they are black? Or will they see through Biden's gambit as a patronizing and empty gesture, which underestimates the political sophistication of African Americans and other so-called minority voters? Frankly, I'm worried, because if Biden is going to pick a black woman, I feel it should be somebody who would fire up the minority base. Let it be a Barbara Lee, a Carol Bass, a Stacey Abrams, a Val Demings, someone who really would fire up the progressive and voters of color. And it's interesting that I think that this whole conundrum that Biden is facing in terms of picking a minority candidate to be his running mate is part of a phenomenon that it comes from the white supremacist hierarchy that we have in this country. And it's a phenomenon referred to by black scholars as colorism. And a fascinating example of it in a movie that came out a few years ago called Marshall. It was a biopic about Thurgood Marshall, the first black Supreme Court justice who served for many years. And oddly, the actor who was cast in the role of Thurgood Marshall was Chadwick Boseman, a great actor, but a very dark-skinned black man. Thurgood Marshall was a very light-skinned black man. And the critique of this movie comes from Angelica Jade Bastien, who argues that this really distorted the whole story about Thurgood Marshall, who was given greater access and who rose through the hierarchy toward the Supreme Court because, she argues, because he was a light-skinned black person. And so oddly, in this film, the tendency to use light-skinned black people to play roles that would be more appealing to white viewers, that phenomenon was reversed in this movie. And she says, typically films will cast actors in roles they are ill-suited for. Marshall is a rare example of the opposite happening, but it's just as insidious. It signals that the film deems colorism and the way it touches Marshall's life as inconsequential to blackness and the history it seeks to untangle. So being light-skinned granted Thurgood Marshall access, and that is a serious missing element from the film. So I think this is what we're grappling here with Biden's toying with the idea of picking a black woman for vice president. Should it be somebody who will keep white voters from fleeing in terror, or it should be somebody who would fire up the African-American and minority base? And I think that he is cutting it very, very close to the line, and he may actually be fumbling here because black people are much more sophisticated as voters than he's giving them credit for.
Well, right now we're joined by John Nichols. Welcome to the program, John. Glad you could be here with us this morning.
You both.
So John Nichols, as many of our listeners are aware, writes about politics for The Nation magazine and is its national affairs correspondent. John is also a contributing writer for the Progressive magazine In These Times and associate editor at the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He's the author of many books. Recent titles include Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America, as well as The Genius of Impeachment. His newest book, just out, is titled The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. John, again, it's a pleasure to have you on our show this morning.
Good to be with you, my friends.
John, since your book is timely and is either just out or about to
it's
be out, the areas you cover in that book, and as you do reflect back on a time when, before the Cold War had started, when Henry Wallace was considered a viable candidate, somebody who could follow FDR with his increasingly progressive agenda at the end of his life.
Sure. Well, the book really is a history of the Democratic Party in the last 75 years. It starts in the mid-1940s and comes up to right now. In fact, it closes with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in Detroit, at near a site where Wallace gave one of his great speeches. So there's a long arc in the book, but it does begin with Roosevelt and Wallace. And what I argue is that in 1940, when Roosevelt added Henry Wallace, the most progressive prominent figure in his cabinet, to his ticket, making Wallace the vice presidential nominee, there was a conscious effort to move the party to the left. Roosevelt scoped out his vision of a Four Freedoms, and then later on spoke of an economic Bill of Rights, literally making rights to health care, housing, transportation, education, and a job not something you might have access to, but something that the government would provide guarantees for. So this was a great move forward. But in 1944, when Roosevelt was ailing and the war was still very much on, the Democratic Party chose to get rid of Wallace. They forced Wallace off the ticket and moved a more centrist, more cautious figure, Harry Truman, in for vice president. Mm-hmm. That was a critical choice that the party made. They chose to, you know, isolate and reject the more progressive contender. And my argument is that set a pattern for the party that exists to this day. Again and again and again, the Democratic Party has rejected progressives who really are talking about doing the necessary steps in the moment. And in doing so, the party has stalled progress on issues where it could prevail. I mean, where polling and everything else suggests that people are ready for big change. And in that sense, the book is a cautionary tale. It's a warning to Democrats that when they do this, they make a bad error, not just for their own party, because they sap dynamism from their own party ultimately, but also for the country. Henry Wallace spoke about the need to address racism, about the need to address sexism at home. In fact, he identified racism and segregationism and the brutal treatment of African Americans in the 1940s as Americanized fascism. He linked the abuse and oppression of people based on their race, based on their gender, based on their class, as something evil, and he wanted the Democratic Party to fight against it. The party chose not to fight as hard as it could have or should have, and we had, you know, generations. We continue to have challenges to this day, horrific challenges that should have been addressed long ago. And my argument is that as the Democratic Party prepares now to convene in convention and nominate Joe Biden and someone for vice president, they ought to be thinking a lot more about this history. That doesn't make the party inferior to the Republicans. The Republicans have steered themselves on an extreme right course that is incredibly dangerous, incredibly damaging. But it does make the party, when it pulls its punches, when the Democratic Party is too cautious, too compromised, a less effective force in fighting against the Republicans and fighting against right-wing orthodoxy than it should be.
John, thank you. And I think during this conversation, we're going to refer to the things you explore in your new book. But I wanted to have you give your analysis of what's going on right now with the Republican Party and their unwillingness to negotiate a sound plan to extend unemployment insurance, to also extend the moratorium on evictions and provide vital funds for state and local governments, you know, in this crisis, which is in a deep recession. Our government, our country's in a really deep recession, and we could be, you know, teetering on the brink of a full-blown depression if, you know, 28 million people are thrown out of their homes and all that goes with that. I mean, that is something that can spin out of control. The motivation for the Republicans here, I've my own take on this is that they've given up on winning the election and that they're trying to burn the economy in the country down to make it as difficult as possible for the next government, which will be dominated by the Democrats probably in the White House, the House, and the Senate. And they're trying to set them up for failure. What's your idea as to why they're trying to burn this country down? It seems like a conscious effort.
It's a thoughtful analysis there, Scott. And let's pull it apart a little bit and say that in almost every sense, the Republican Party of today is returning to its Herbert Hoover roots. And it is very important to understand that when the Great Depression hit and it began to really gain traction, 1929, 1930, 1931, Herbert Hoover, who up to that point had been viewed as a capable manager, absolutely botched the response. He made things worse. And I would argue that in that case, Hoover didn't necessarily make things worse because he intended to. Certainly, I don't think he wanted to. I think he simply had the wrong ideas in his head. I mean, he was thinking in the wrong way. He rejected a bold, sufficiently bold government response, and instead, with an insufficient response, created a situation of enormous suffering, enormous pain, that then did lead to a transformation moment, a huge transformation moment in our politics with the election of Roosevelt and the Democrats in 1932. And what's important to understand is there are still Republicans who, like Herbert Hoover, think in the wrong way. They literally believe that a small government response, an insufficient response, is the appropriate way to deal with a challenge like this. And I think you have to accept that there are some folks for whom it is simply ideological, that's where they're at. Are there other folks, strategic players, who might, as you suggest, want to basically hand off as big a mess as they can to the next administration? It essentially, whether it's intentional or whether they've simply given up on trying to solve it and, you know, just want to walk away from it, I think there's very little doubt that some of that exists. And what you want to recognize here is that no matter whether it is purely ideological or purely cynical, you know, literally trying to jump ship before it goes down, doesn't matter so much. What matters is that the Democrats are likely, not certain by any means, and we can talk a lot about the mess with election processes, but are likely to take over from a Republican administration that has created a disaster. And the question is, how do you respond to that? If you simply seek to manage the disaster, right, that you try to make things a little better, you will play into the Republicans' hands. You'll end up in a situation where, in very short order, by 2022, 2024, voters are, saying, well, the Democrats couldn't handle it either. And so this becomes a great test for the Democratic Party. It's a question of, can they take power and really change the direction of the country, do fundamental things that are necessary? And that, of course, you know it as well as I. It is to, prevent the evictions, prevent people from losing their homes, develop jobs programs, develop guaranteed income programs, step in with a national health care program, do big, bold, incredible things which are necessary, not ideological, but simply required of the moment. If the Democrats do that, whatever the Republicans have done, for whatever reason, can be undone. The crisis can be averted. But that's a really big deal. It is, it is the challenge of the moment, the challenge for the Democrats to be bold enough for the situation that they may inherit. There's one other thing I would really strongly emphasize. They have to point fingers of blame. I cannot begin to establish how important it is to identify the culprits and keep doing so. Franklin Roosevelt, as an example, never stopped talking about what Hoover did. He never stopped talking about what the Republicans did. He never stopped talking about what Wall Street did. He literally said, I welcome their hatred. That's a vital way of thinking about this, because if you just say, oh, well, that was a rough time, now we're going to pass beyond it and go on to the next moment, you lose the ability to identify where the problem is. So twofold. One, big, bold responses, and two, a constant pointing of the finger of blame so that no one has any lack of clarity about who caused the crisis.
I would ask our other panelists on the phone line, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, do you have a question for or a comment about this subject or any other subject, Ruth?
Well, I have a little concern, and then I have maybe a bigger question. I have a concern, John, that the evictions could be, in some Republican minds, a cool way to suppress the vote of a particular segment of our population who are likely to vote Democratic if they vote at all. Because it's my understanding that if you have no place of residence, it's very difficult to vote. It can be done, but it's hoops to jump through, and it's more likely that people would give up before they would persevere. And this is just something that I've wished. I watch news all the time, and nobody is talking about it. So maybe it isn't a concern, but for me, it seems very scary. And the other thing is, I'm wondering if Biden has anybody to listen to who's going to urge the direction that you're urging, because it seems to me to be absolutely necessary. Pointing blame and moving the party in a bold way to address the mess that we're facing, rather than to make accommodations and to adjust and modify and et cetera.
Well, I appreciate both your comments, and I think that you get to a really important thing in your comment there on the evictions, the loss of homes, the chaos that frankly comes in a moment of economic meltdown. And that is a vital issue as regards elections, because when people are literally dealing with questions of whether they can survive economically, whether they have the housing that they need, whether they have some way to support their families, that is a time in which their focus has to be on these human needs. And it does sometimes, not always, make it harder for folks to vote, make it harder for them to participate in the processes of self-governance. And so this has to be something we're conscious of. And we have to be talking about it in precisely the ways you're talking about it, making sure, you know, whether I'm less concerned about the notion that there's conspiracies or things like that. I'm more concerned about the practical reality. And that practical reality means that for Democrats, for progressives, there have to be big programs to make sure, A, that the evictions, the loss of homes don't occur, and B, that if they do occur, that people still have access to the franchise, have a way to vote. And especially as we're going to absentee voting, hopefully in some cases mail voting, that's a big deal, because if people are, you know, moving from address to address, if they're looking for housing, all these things become harder. So it is something to put at the top of agendas and at the top of concerns. Now, on the second thing that you raised, this question of whether Biden's getting good advice, yeah, he's getting good advice from people like Bernie Sanders, who are saying, right, you know, go big, go bold. Hopefully he will take some of it. Joe Biden cannot be ignorant of these realities. He cannot be ignorant of these necessities. I mean, he knows. It's, you know, if you read the papers, I mean, it's not a secret. But this is what I mean by a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. There will always be folks within the Democratic Party who argue for that bigger, bolder, and necessary response. There will also be folks who argue for a more cautious, more centrist, more Wall Street-friendly response. That's gone on for 75 years. It will continue to go on. It's going on right now. And my message is simply that if Democrats don't recognize the need for boldness and the need to point those fingers of blame, if they don't put those two things together, they run the profound risk of inheriting power, but using that power insufficiently. And instead of transforming the country and moving in the right direction, perhaps maintaining a crisis that is not only an economic and social crisis, but also a political crisis.
Can I ask just one follow-up, John? I know a lot of us progressives were distressed that Obama didn't pursue any kind of sanctions against, any punishment for the Republicans who had made such a mess, especially the Guantanamo, et cetera, what they had done. And I was talking to a lot of people who said, oh, it's a wise thing to reconcile. He did run on trying to make the two parties speak to one another and cooperate. But do you think that he made a misstep in not pursuing not pursuing some kind of charges, at least over what had happened with Guantanamo, et cetera, sure. Iraq?
I think on so many issues, the Obama administration should have been more aggressive in pointing the finger of blame and seeking accountability. But I wouldn't be overly rough on Barack Obama for that. I mean, I have criticisms of President Obama on a lot of issues. But, you know, he came in at a moment where there was a great deal of hope, and there was a great deal of belief that it was going to be possible to move forward. What we should do, instead of getting upset with President Obama in this case, is to recognize that his administration, his tenure, taught us something. And it taught Democrats, or it should have taught Democrats, that if you do not pursue accountability, if you do not point the finger of blame aggressively and consistently, if you do not investigate, prosecute, and demand that the guilty men stand down, that those who did wrong be forever marked with their wrong, and that be remembered, that it be remembered that a George W. Bush and Dick Cheney led us into an illegal and immoral war, that they did tax cuts for the rich and policies that dramatically weakened our economy at a critical stage. If you don't do that, then yeah, the Republicans in this case will come back and kind of reclaim the political ground. And so I think the accountability stuff is really, really important. It's not the most important thing. The most important thing is those big, bold programs that address people's needs and address their challenges and you know, bring a humane and responsible and decent approach to governance. But to achieve that, to get those big, bold responses in place, you also need to have an accountability mechanism. And so I put those two pieces together.
Thank you. That was a great answer. Thank you.
John, this is Richard Hill. We've been focusing a lot on, in this conversation, about, you know, how the Democrats should govern once they've gained power. But would you give your assessment of how the Democrats are doing now leading up to the election in order to win that election? What are they doing right and what are they doing wrong? And I would break that into two categories of the leaders in the House and the Senate, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, and the Biden campaign itself. What kind of grade would you give them, and what suggestions do you have for them?
Just an okay grade, not a great one. I think that the platform at this point is insufficient. It's better in some ways than previous platforms, but it doesn't have Medicare for all. It doesn't embrace a Green New Deal. It doesn't call for legalization of marijuana. It doesn't call for some of the sweeping changes in policing that even members of Congress have accepted. And so I think that the Democrats are on a number of fronts pulling their punches at a time when they should be throwing them. I think that Joe Biden is running at this point a relatively cautious campaign. It seems to be going well. I'm not criticizing that. You know, his poll numbers are decent. But the danger of that caution is twofold. Number one, it could lead to a weaker turnout than is necessary. Biden doesn't need a win. He needs a massive win, and he needs the Democrats to take the Senate in a big way so that he can actually govern. And I think that some of the softness of his campaign is dangerous in that regard. Secondly, I think that the other danger is that political parties often put their best face on when they're campaigning and actually govern more cautiously even than how they campaign. And if Biden is setting a trajectory here for cautious governance at a point when bold governance is needed, that's a very dangerous thing. It's not just dangerous politically, it's frankly dangerous to the country. And so I'm concerned about how Biden is approaching this. It's one of the reasons why I think it is important to talk about these fights for the soul of the Democratic Party, and frankly for progressives to keep pushing. It is entirely possible to keep two thoughts in your head. Number one, that Donald Trump must be defeated. And number two, that the Democratic Party and progressives must be bolder than they have been up to this point. These are not irreconcilable notions. In fact, they are parallel notions. And I think if they're put together, the chances of those bigger victories and that real progress become much greater.
John, we're just about out of time, and thank you so much for spending your time with us this morning. I had a question that involves speculation that's been out there for some time that if Donald Trump is defeated in the November election, he may refuse to leave office. He may say the election was rigged. We've already seen previews of what he might do to throw a monkey wrench in the process and to try to delegitimize it. My question revolves around what we as citizens must do if Donald Trump does pull something off, such as trying to stay in office despite an election defeat. It seems like I don't want to trust Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer with that. I think we need to be out in the streets en masse to demand the system work as it was designed and to uphold and respect democracy. It seems like that will be an extremely important moment in American history. And I don't want to leave it up to politicians. What are some of your thoughts?
I appreciate some of your thoughts there. And look, number one, the best way to avert that sort of crisis, that sort of challenge, is a big, big, big victory for Trump's opposition. And that's about more than Biden, more than the Democrats. It is this understanding that beating Trump is a bigger thing than just an individual or even a party. And so, you know, having a big victory in November for the anti-Trump forces makes it much easier to get that transition. If Trump does try to hang on, you know, my sense is it will be very unsuccessful because there will be massive opposition. But, yeah, we'd borrow lessons from other countries around the world and from our own history. The fact of the matter is that we've had examples from places like Korea where, you know, massive opposition to corrupt governance and to bad players has led to transformational change. You know, and how do they do it? By putting huge portions of the population in the streets, you know, in mass demonstrations of opposition to corrupt and dangerous governance. We should be able to do the same. I mean, it's as simple as that. And we do have a tradition of assembling and petitioning for the redress of our grievances. It has, in this country, a rich and long history of achieving fundamental change. And if it is necessary, yes, people should be in the streets protesting, you know, raising a cry for you know, the respect for the will of the electorate. To be honest with you, I doubt we'll get there. I doubt that will be necessary, because my gut instinct is that Trump has so discredited himself that there will be a substantial rejection of him this fall. But you know, my doubts are not sufficient there. You know, you still have to prepare for a challenging moment. And so as citizens organize for making sure we have a huge turnout, huge vote in November, they should also be organizing to make sure that if there is a failure of Trump to do as he must, and if he's defeated, to stand down, then people have to be in the streets.
John, thank you so much for spending time with us here on Resistance Roundtable this morning. Appreciate all your analysis, and you're a great friend to this station and to community radio. So thanks for all you do.
And John, let's repeat the title of your new book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Hank Wallace's Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist and Anti-Racist Politics. Extremely germane. And indeed, an excellent launchpad for this discussion today. So thank you for doing all the work that you do and keeping WPKN in your little family of independent radio that you contribute to. It's so much appreciated.
It's an honor to be with you. Thanks again. And carry on.
Thank you.
Take care, John.
Bye-bye, John.
Bye-bye.
Well, we have a few minutes. How many minutes do we have? We have just about 7 minutes, as is our tradition. We open up the phones now for anybody who would like to ask a question or make a comment about anything we've talked about or any other topic related to the politics of the day. If you'd like to join in the conversation with Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Scott Harris, and myself, Richard Hill, number is 203-336-9756. 203-336-9756. As we come down the home stretch of the show, any other thoughts, Ruth Ann?
I was excited voting by mail, even though I don't think that the Democratic primary is up for grabs in Connecticut at the moment. But it was exciting to vote by mail, and it seemed to be a system that would work very nicely as from my point of view. I have some other friends who were very excited to vote by mail, too.
Yeah.
So I guess that is my other big, my big event of the week was voting by mail.
Yeah, I did too. Not ashamed to say I voted for Bernie Sanders, kind of as a strategic signaling to the National Democratic Party and the people that are going to be approving the platform at the Democratic Convention. The progressive tradition represented by Bernie Sanders needs to be taken into account and made manifest. 203-336-9756. You yourself, caller, might get the last word on today's Resistance Roundtable. So,
I just want to mention very briefly.
Yeah,
I have attempted to get an absentee ballot, almost as a test run for what happens in November, and my application for an absentee ballot came back twice, and I still haven't received it. In other words, it was returned to me. It was a total mess and still is a mess. I still don't have one.
Mine came back once because I had folded the piece of paper wrong.
Well, this is a minefield.
And my address was showing in the envelope.
It's a minefield.
So, Scott, they sent you your request form.
Yeah.
You filled it out, sent it back.
It came back to me in error, and I sent it back out again, and it came back again a second time, and then we dropped it off at the clerk's office. Still don't have an absentee ballot.
What was the error?
I still don't know.
They didn't tell you. They just said reject. I wondered, this point I raised about the vice presidential pick, running mate for Joe Biden, one of the elements that a candidate of that ilk could bring to a campaign is kind of a balancing act between a very centrist candidate, Joe Biden, and a vice presidential candidate who could sort of steer or influence that candidate to be more progressive. And I'm worried that Kamala Harris and Susan Rice are not those candidates.
Hi, caller. You're on the air. Hopefully we got you this time.
I'm here.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do ask for an absentee ballot, and I'd called last Monday about it, and because I hadn't seen it, and I still haven't seen it. And, you know, tomorrow morning Monday morning we'll ask again what exactly happened.
Yeah, I had some discussions with Greg Palast about absentee ballots, and I didn't really know the extent that it would affect me personally, but it is a minefield with all sorts of folds and addresses and checkboxes that you can very easily ignore, even if you're trying to pay close attention to what they're asking you to do on these forms. And I guess you and I are both victims of that, and probably thousands, hundreds of thousands all over the country.
We're going to have a mess. We can be pretty sure of that. But all this is done by the Secretary of State. It's not done by the local towns. Am I correct there?
No. Well, in my case, it's a local town, but town clerk.
What's your town, caller?
Easton. Well, yeah, it was my understanding this all came through the state, or the request was from the state, and the ballots actually get issued by the towns?
I think they have to be because, well, maybe not. No, there are no... I think I succeeded in voting absentee or, you know, vote by mail in Brantford. It all seemed to go smoothly. Now, as to whether my vote, which I just sent in a couple of days ago, actually gets received and tallied is a whole another story. But there are opportunities for bureaucratic foul-ups here.
Yeah, it's totally. Yes, it could be. Well, I would just advise everybody out there who is planning to vote absentee this Tuesday for the primary or for the general election in November to pay very, very close attention to all the instructions and try to follow them as best you can, because it is a minefield.
And also, people should make sure that they're actually registered to vote. I can't tell you what that link is off the top of my head, but it's very easy to check your registration status.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to keep asking people to do that, to make sure there's no fun and games, and then it's too late.
That, of course, is critical, yes.
All right, thanks, folks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Excellent question. Yeah, I think that the primary, which I think is the votes will be tallied on August 11th, is a good practice run for November 3rd. And so hopefully the glitches that we experience now will be ironed out by November 3rd. All right. Anyway, you've been listening to the Resistance Roundtable on WPKN. We come to you the second Saturday of each month from 10 to 11 a.m. I want to thank Scott Harris, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, yours truly, Richard Hill, who are here each show to talk about the hot button issues of that particular period. So join us again in, September for the next edition of Resistance Roundtable. And until then, stay safe, wear your mask, and keep a distance from human beings. They are your enemies. Cross the street when you see one coming. You're listening to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, streaming online at WPKN.org. And stay tuned for more great programming. Barricada is next.